From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canary. We're continuing our weekly COVID-19 update today. Another week has passed, and while the number of new cases continues to increase across all of Florida and across southwest Florida, the rate of increase has slowed down in Lee, Collier, and Charlotte counties. Last week, Lee County only saw 147 new cases. That's compared to a 253-case increase last week. There were 90 new cases in Collier County. That's versus 144 last Monday versus the week prior. And in Charlotte County, there were only 22 new cases. That's versus a 70-case increase last week. There has been a near doubling in cases in Hendry County week to week, up to 42 in all. Glades County is still reporting 5 cases. Overall, according to the Florida Department of Health's COVID-19 data and surveillance dashboard, the latest count puts the number of confirmed cases in all of Florida at 26,660. That's up from 20,601 last Monday and 13,324 at this time 2 weeks ago. To get the latest on what Lee Health is experiencing, we're joined this week by Chris Semino. He's Lee Health's Chief Foundation and Development Officer. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined again this week by Dr. Doug Brust. He's an infectious disease doctor with Lee Health and is the lead researcher on the new convalescent plasma trial Lee Health has been selected to participate in, which we'll get details on in a bit. Dr. Brust, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
And in a few minutes, we'll talk again with John Kling. He's Chief Nursing Officer at NCH Healthcare System. We are live on the air and streaming on the WGCU Public Media Facebook page. So if you'd like to weigh in, ask a question there, or on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. So, Chris, just let's start with you. What's the overall tone right now across Lee Health's hospitals and facilities, week over week?
I think we're doing well. Our staff is positive. We have seen a leveling off of cases. We are right now at about 62% capacity in our hospitals. That's remained steady. Our COVID patients have remained about steady over time. We're starting to see the benefits of the social distancing. And so our hospitals are doing well right now.
How many confirmed cases, positive cases, has Lee Health seen overall at this point?
I can't tell you overall. We have 74 in our hospitals today. We've been involved with about 430 of the positive COVID cases of the total of 779 that we have seen in Lee County.
Understood. Last week, when we talked to Lisa, the in-house testing had begun. I'm wondering, has that been scaled up at all? And then secondarily, how long does an average test take at this point?
Sure. It has gone extremely well. We have done about 200 tests per day. That's not all that we can do. Some of the tests are sent out to commercial labs. It depends on the insurance that you might have or the requirements from your doctor. But all the tests that we can do in-house, we are doing in-house. As of this morning, we have 0 tests pending because we've run all of them. They generally take about 45 minutes to run, but that's not how quickly we can get the results back because you have to go from the collection center to the lab, do the testing, do the analysis, connect with the doctor. So we're saying we can get things back in less than 24 hours. So having in-house testing has really been a game changer for us.
Mobile testing going on at about the same rate as it's been going on for the past few weeks?
Yeah, it's slowed down a little bit. We do about 200 to 300 a day. We closed down our Cape Coral location yesterday on Sunday because we didn't have a lot of appointments there. We kept up our Page Field location, and that was busy. So all of those tests are in and have been run.
Is the Cape Coral test site closed for good unless things turn around, or is that just a short-term thing?
No, we just closed it on Sunday due to the lack of appointments. It's back open today, as is the Page Field location.
Understood. And how are we looking, or how are you looking in terms of personal protective equipment? I know it's a shifting target each week. You go through a certain amount, and you try to get a certain amount. How is that dynamic working out right now?
I think overall we're in good shape. We have had incredible generosity from our community, from landscapers and country clubs and builders, and everyone has been looking through their supplies and donating PPE to the hospital. We've received just a tremendous amount of generous donations. Our supply chain team is working day and night to make sure we have the supplies we need. Right now, we're very comfortable with what we have. We have two real issues we're trying to pursue. One is the N95 masks, which are the masks that the healthcare workers use when they're dealing with the COVID patients. We're repurposing them, and we're trying to find as many of those as possible. We have enough, but it's always good to be prepared. And the second is gowns. We're going through gowns, and we'd love to have more gowns.
What about ventilators? Are you stocked up enough to cover what you have now with some room to spare?
Yeah, we're very comfortable where we are with our ventilators. We were able to secure some additional ventilators, and so we only have about one-third of our ventilators in use today.
Have any additional Lee Health staff members tested positive in the past week or so?
I can't tell you the last couple of days or weeks, but we have about 37 employees who have tested positive so far, five of whom have recovered and returned to work.
Okay. And how many employees are self-isolating because of exposure at this point? Has that shifted that much since the last week or so?
Well, that changes as the weeks go by. As people might have become exposed, they then go and self-monitor or self-isolate. We have about 150 employees that are self-monitoring due to exposures at work, and then an additional about 200 employees that are self-monitoring at home due to other exposures in their community or travel or things like that.
Gotcha. And we will talk to Doug Brust in more detail later in the show about the convalescent plasma study, but that seems like a pretty good thing to be happening here locally.
I'll leave that up to Dr. Brust to tell you about.
Okay. Chris Simoneau is Chief Foundation and Development Officer at Lee Health. Chris, thanks for your time. Dr. Brust, let's talk real quick about that convalescent plasma study. Tell us the basics on it before we move on to John Kling in Collier County.
Okay, great. So a convalescent plasma, what that refers to is for a number of diseases, viral diseases, we know that antibodies are important when you recover. So if you are donating blood and were able to get the plasma from a person that had COVID-19, in that plasma would be antibodies. So we can transfer those antibodies to a person that's acutely ill, and we hope that it will actually help them. So this is a clinical trial, so we don't know the answer to that yet. But this has been done for a number of other viral infections, including our H1N1 influenza in 2009, and all the way back to the Spanish flu in 2018, to try to help the patient get over the acute disease.
And this is being coordinated by Mayo Clinic, so the idea is that you are just one of many locations that will be collecting data that will be aggregated by them or somebody even maybe farther up the chain than them. It's just this is a study that you're
right.
One of the spokes in the wheel, right?
Right. So this is actually a very novel way to go about it for a novel virus. Not to get into the weeds, what happened is that the FDA allowed you to use this technique for an individual patient. And so what Mayo went around and did, that was called an emergency use authorization, sort of emergency IND. What Mayo did is they said, hey, if you want to become partner with us and open this at your site, you could become an investigator and then at your site that you're at, and then you can open our trial. And they're really looking at some very, very simple things. The first thing that they're actually looking at in this trial is, hey, can you actually get the plasma and give it to someone? So that's the first endpoint. It's not even looking at whether people get better or not, but can we do it? So our major focus right now is the clinical trial itself is giving the plasma to people. The non-clinical trial part is actually obtaining the plasma. So what we need to do is find people that have recovered from COVID-19 that had a positive test for the virus, and now they're better, and we're looking for them to come and donate blood that we could obtain plasma from that. So that's the first part that we're looking for right now, and we opened that this morning.
And so you're looking for volunteers. So if anybody listening is someone or knows someone who tested positive but has recovered, they can come in and give blood?
Yes, they can. They can come in and give blood. There will be contact information. We can post it. We have an email and a phone number. We prefer people to email. It's a COVID email address to any of our blood centers or our, they actually have a mobile unit also. You have to go through some screening to make sure that you are over it clinically. And then we also repeat the nasal pharyngeal swab, or actually they do it a little bit differently now, just to make sure that you don't have any RNA that's still there.
Okay, Dr. Brust, hold on. We'll pick back up with you in a little bit, but let's pivot now to Collier County. John Kling is Chief Nursing Officer at NCH Healthcare System. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
And again, we are live, so if you'd like to ask a question, go to Facebook, find a post for this show's live stream on WGCU Public Media's Facebook page and do it there. Or you can weigh in on Twitter. We're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, John, same basic questions. How are things going in NCH Healthcare Systems hospitals? What's the sort of the overall tone right now? It looks like from the numbers, things have slowed down a little bit.
Yeah. Yes, they have. We are seeing... Hopefully this is a sign of things to come, but we are seeing a sign of flattening of this. Our numbers have of positive COVID cases have declined over the past 10 to 14 days. We're running on the average of around 27 to 28 positive COVID patients a day. Currently we're at 14 positive COVID patients and 29 persons under investigation. So it has come down a little bit. I think the social distancing has started to work a little bit to reduce some of the exposures here in Collier County.
Has the means of testing at all changed since last Monday when we spoke in terms of the balance between in-house and out-of-house and things like that?
So we're still, that's one of our rate-limiting factors, and you know I agree with our lead partners. The in-house testing really is a game-changer. We've had limited amount of test kits for in-house testing. We're still sending the majority of our tests to Quest Labs and the state-run labs as well. So, and we're just working very closely with Lee Health to help do tests for us when needed, and also working with our vendors. Since we have multiple platforms that can do in-house testing, we're just waiting on those manufacturers to release more kits to us.
And the mobile testing still about the same as before?
Yeah, you know, we've actually increased our mobile testing now that our state health department, our state health labs, and our commercial labs are turning the tests around quicker. We are beginning to see more availability of the swab test kits, so we're doing 50 a day at the Baker campus, and we're filling those up every day. So we're still doing quite a bit of testing. That's good as well because it keeps those worried well out of the ED or the physician offices, and we can get those tests returned back in 1 to 2 days on average, usually one now we're seeing. So it's getting quicker turnaround time.
Do you know if there's enough demand for mobile testing that if you could scale up and get more tests that you could open another site and get just as many people coming to it?
We think we could at this time. It's we don't have any trouble filling up our 50 appointments a day, so I think there could be potential for that.
What is the current state of your personal protective equipment supplies?
We're in a good place. I really wanted to commend our supply purchasing team and Matt Stasel, our director for supply chain services. He's done a yeoman's job here in a Herculean effort to get us prepared. We're prepared. We're ordering enough PPEs to get us through many, many months in the future. And as we look at what's the new normal going to be with this, is PPE will probably be an increased factor in our day-to-day operations. So we're looking at increasing our PAR levels over historic volumes just as we're still trying to figure out how this is going to progress going forward. But planning for the worst and being prepared is a smart move, I believe.
And your ventilator supply is adequate, or you know you have enough of an extra in case there's another spike?
Yes. We currently only have about 15 ventilators being used today in our hospital, give or take, 10 to 15, and we have 183. So that is over triple the capacity of our actual critical care beds. So I think we're in a good place if we continue to do good social distancing and follow the requirements of CDC and the Department of Health. We should have plenty of ventilators to take care of our patients and some.
Are you still seeing a decline in the number of people coming into the hospital for other things because they don't want to? The perception is they might get COVID-19 while they're there.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up because I really wanted to spend the majority of the time of this call to let your listeners know and our community know that there is a very structured process for any patient coming into our ERs. We have 5 ERs in our healthcare system. At all 5 of our ERs, you're met with a screener at the entrance in full PPE, personal protective equipment, to ask a series of COVID-19 questions. If you answer the questions, please answer them honestly. Your care will not change despite your answers. If you answer some of the COVID-19 questions, you get sent to a separate area. It's an isolation area. where you're not going to be exposed to anybody else. All of our staff are in PPE protective equipment. If you answer no to the questions, you go a different pathway, and those staff are still in protective equipment, so there's virtually no risk of exposure. I think there's more of a risk to ignoring your health care than there's to COVID. I really want to make sure that people understand, do not ignore those signs and symptoms of chest pain or stroke or elevated blood sugars or whatever your chronic illness is if you have them. You know, it is safe to come to the hospitals. Lee Health, ourselves, our partners in Cuyahoga County, we all have measures in place to protect our staff and our patients. Please don't ignore your health.
All right, that is all the time for this segment. John Kling is Chief Nursing Officer at NCH Healthcare System. John, thank you so much for your time again, and we will talk to you in the future.
Thank you so much. Take care.
If you're just joining the show today, we've been getting updates from NCH Healthcare System and Lee Health about the COVID-19 response. For the rest of the show, we're going to get an update from the world of virology and what's being learned by researchers. I'm joined by Dr. Sharon E. Cern. She's a molecular virologist and professor at Florida Gulf Coast University. Sharon, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Mike. Glad to be back.
And coming back into the conversation now is Dr. Doug Brust. He's an infectious disease doctor with Lee Health. Dr. Brust, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. And I just want to underscore what John said about coming to the hospital if you're sick. That really was a very important point that he made.
Okay, and we are actually, I have a conversation set up for tomorrow with Dr. Larry Hobbs from Lee Health to dig further into that. So expect that coming up down the road. We are live, so if you'd like to ask a question, go over to Facebook and leave it there, or you can go to Twitter. We're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So Dr. Brust, real quick, back to the convalescent plasma study. We received a question from Jason on Facebook wondering that if you've had symptoms and recovered but never got an official test, can you still try to donate plasma, or is that a hard red line?
At the moment, it's a hard red line, but we want to hear from those people. First of all, I want to just back up and sort of say that this was a Herculean effort to get this clinical trial up and running, and I really have to thank, I mean, almost the list, it's a laundry list of people that I would thank, but the Shipley Cardiac Thoracic Research Team really helped enormously in actually designing, getting into effect, and actually executing the trial. So we don't have an antibody test that we're using routinely. So for folks that actually were in the community and thought they had COVID-19, there's no test that we're using routinely here. They're available, but testing is sort of a very difficult situation. But we want to hear from people that think that they've had it, because we're going to, if they're interested in donating plasma, when we get a test together that we'll be doing, we'll contact them again.
We will talk a little bit more about antibody testing here in a bit, but so what you're saying then, just to clarify, is that once you do have the ability to test for antibodies, just because they didn't test positive for COVID-19 at some point in the past doesn't necessarily at that point mean they can't donate plasma at that point.
That's exactly right. But at the moment, we can't capture that group of people to donate plasma because we don't have an antibody test to demonstrate whether or not they actually had COVID-19.
Do you know if there's going to be any centralized repository for convalescent plasma? As you know, it seems like the whole world could be producing it at this point if there was enough coordination, so that way you wouldn't have to be finding it locally in order to test it locally.
So that's exactly what the Mayo protocol was looking to do. Using the protocol itself actually gives the plasma, but they're looking for a repository within the Red Cross. So the Red Cross is collecting plasma also to it centrally. The way we set it up at Lee is that we're going to have people donate at our blood bank so that we can use it for our patients. So we can be in control of it that way. So it's a community giving back to the community in this way. And once again, this is a clinical trial. So we do not know whether or not, convalescent plasma helps in this disease or not. And, you know, when you enter in a clinical trial, there are risks and there are benefits that can happen. The risks are, you know, you can have a transfusion reaction from getting plasma. But that risk, you know, we're used to. We don't know what, you know, the benefit, if any, is from using convalescent plasma for someone that has COVID-19 active disease.
Gotcha. So I mentioned before, we're starting to hear a lot about blood tests that can see if you've had it. These are antibody tests. Lots of them are starting to hit the market. Sharon, and feel free to weigh in here too. Can one of you explain what these tests are doing and basically how they work?
Yes, there are actually two different kinds of antibody tests. One is called the rapid point of care lateral flow assay, and this one is similar to like a pregnancy test where it gives you a positive or positive or negative on the spot. And then the second test is called an ELISA assay, and that stands for enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay. This one will actually quantify. It will give you a number. It's not just a positive or negative. It tells you how much as far as the concentration of antibodies. And this one requires a laboratory to be able to run, so it's not as quick as the rapid flow. And the FDA has allowed, I think, over 70 companies right now to be selling COVID-19 different types of antibody tests with different types of authorization. And so there's a lot of tests out there. The difficult thing right now is to validate these tests. Not all of them are accurate. And there are groups out there that are trying to compare all these different tests to see, you know, which ones are doing what they claim to do.
There's an antibody test thing going on out in California where they're doing blood tests on people, and it seems like what it's showing is an order of magnitude maybe more people are showing antibodies than people who tested positive at some point. Can you reflect on that?
I think you're referring to the Santa Clara County study in California. Yeah, they showed that 2.5 to 4.2% of the people had been exposed. So they actually tested over 3,000 people and found that 50 to 85-fold more people had been exposed to coronavirus than the number of confirmed cases. So, many more people than actually tested positive just because they didn't get tested. Most of them probably were asymptomatic and never got tested for virus. They tested positive for antibody later on.
Dr. Brust?
I just want to jump in just to underscore what Sharon has said, because the performance of these tests, we just don't know. I think there are 70 or so tests out there. We don't know like what antibodies some of them are measuring. Whether they're neutralizing antibodies that would help in protective immunity, like that you couldn't get reinfected. And then also, we don't know whether or not when you develop these antibodies. And sometimes what they're doing is with those lateral flow tests, people are marking them to test for acute disease. And that we definitely know that you can't do. Because the thought is that antibodies become, you know, people start producing antibodies about day 10 after being clinically ill. So if you start doing one of these antibody tests, like when a person comes in and they're just sick to begin with, it'll definitely be negative, but they might have the disease.
Doug, last week you talked about how the normal tests, not the antibody tests, but the PCR tests, I think they're called, how the quicker tests that are being used have a higher or an unknown range of false negatives and false positives. Can you just talk a little bit more about that to explain that in more detail?
Well, so nucleic amplification, acid amplification. So the virus is an RNA virus. So PCR is called polymerase chain reaction. So what it does is it actually is able to amplify. If you have a little bit of the RNA from the virus, you're able to amplify it up to detect it. There are a couple issues. So when we talk about the performance of the test, you want to know that when you do a test on someone and it's positive, that really represents that they have that disease or that virus. And when it's negative, that means that they don't have that disease or are infected with that virus. So that's the positive predictive value and the negative predictive value. Now, no test is 100%, you know, sensitive and specific. So they can get really, really close. But before the FDA usually approves the test, we have all this worked out. Now we're working it out as we go. So when you do nucleic acid amplification, like the PCR, if you are positive and you're, you know, the lab, you know, is a good lab that you're not going to get contamination, the positive predictive value of that is pretty good. It's really good. So that means you have RNA there. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you actually have infectious virus or that you are infectious to other people, but the RNA is there. It's the other part that we don't know about. It's the negative predictive value.
so that when you do the amplification, if it comes out negative, is it really negative? And I think you're referring to a couple studies, and it's a couple things we've already seen here, is that people can test negative by this testing algorithm and then test positive later, with or without symptoms. So it's unclear when you test positive whether that actually represents infectious virus, but it probably does mean that you have RNA there. And when you test negative, we don't know whether you're really negative and whether you're infectious or not. It really depends on how long it's been, you know, since you've had symptoms. So that's why when we're collecting the blood to make plasma, we're asking about symptoms and also testing. I think maybe Sharon can chime in on some of that too.
So, yeah, pretty much what Doug said as far as positive or negatives, and just there's always going to be a little bit of error. You mentioned whether there's contamination, and contamination in the lab is not so much that it's contaminated with other things. It's because you do so many amplifications in a particular
right.
space that it's really easy to pick up little copies of RNA genome that are just sitting around on a benchtop, and so that's where the contamination is coming from. And so at some point, some labs, if you do it often enough with all these samples going through, there's bound to be some false positives as well, just because of the testing procedure.
Right.
And as far as the negatives, there's reports are saying that people are coming out, you know, negative and then testing positive after two negatives, and there could be a whole bunch of reasons, as Doug described, for that. Sometimes these assays are quantitative, and so they do give you a readout number, and it depends on how much virus is present. Sometimes one or a few copies can give you a positive, but if all of a sudden you lower that threshold, you may not see a positive, but then it bumps up back up just a little bit, and all of a sudden the signal comes back up. And so at the low range, it's really easy to get a lot of variability in the low range.
We have a question coming in from Debbie on Facebook. Back to the antibody testing, can you imagine a future where there'll be a finger stick that people can all get tested so we can have sort of collective data on, you know, even something maybe you do at home and you send back in?
Yeah.
I think that's where they're headed, and some of them are being designed as finger prick assays, so not necessarily blood drawn through, you know, having to go to like a Quest Diagnostics or something, but the idea is to have a fingerprint prick where you can get your blood and determine whether or not you've had antibodies to coronavirus using that method.
You can do that for HIV right now.
Right, and that's been available for a very long time, right? So the technology,
yeah.
Once it's refined, it's there.
Yes.
Gotcha. Well, we are going to have to end the show on the radio right now. We're going to continue for the web. The Facebook stream went down, so we will not be continuing on Facebook because we are not on Facebook right now. But let me say goodbye to both of you for now and then just hang out for a minute or so, and then we'll pick back up and we'll add this to what we post on the web. That is all the time we have for the show today. Dr. Sharon Esern is a molecular virologist who's a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at Florida Gulf Coast University. Sharon, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Mike.
And Dr. Doug Brust is an infectious disease doctor with Lee Health. Doug, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Sharon.
And thanks to our earlier guests, John Kling, he's chief nursing officer at NCH Healthcare System, and Chris Semino from Lee Health. If you missed any of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Kanairi. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. All right, Doug and Sharon, you still there?
Yep, still here.
Okay, I do want to talk a little bit more about the antibody stuff, but the other thing that I wanted to talk about is that we're starting to read reports about COVID-19 being linked to a significant number of patients with heart and kidney failure. Can you talk about that? And, you know, A, what do we know about what's going on now? And B, is that sort of something that happens, you know, when you have viruses that affect the body in a way like COVID-19 does?
I can speak to it, yeah.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Oh, okay. So once again, it's an evolving situation as we're learning clinically about how this virus causes disease. and sort of the spectrum of the disease that we're seeing with COVID-19. So as far as sort of in general, you have to think about what is causing the problems that people have, the symptoms that they have, and the clinical issues that they have. Is it a direct effect of the virus on a given tissue, or is it just because the virus itself causes a problem, and then the immune system or the patient's sort of defenses react, and that goes sort of haywire and out of control? Or is it what you're seeing is that people that are very critically ill and very sick will have these other sort of things happen to them just because they're critically ill? So, for example, the issue of kidney failure or kidney disease in COVID-19 with infection with SARS-CoV-2. So when you look at MERS, you know, SARS-CoV-2 is more related to the SARS outbreak that we had before than to MERS, the virus that causes MERS. But there were quite a few people that had kidney issues with MERS. So here we have to find out whether or not we're seeing increases in kidney problems and kidney failure, and some people requiring dialysis, because there's a direct effect of the virus on the kidney, or there's some sort of inflammatory effect after becoming infected with the virus, or it's just because that the patient is so ill. And getting kidney disease is when you're intubated in the intensive care unit is well known to happen because you're on a number of medications that are nephrotoxic, your blood pressure might be low. So untangling it all is not easy. Many, many respiratory viruses can cause direct effects on the heart and produce problems with the heart. This is well known. Influenza can do it. Adenoviruses can do it. So it wouldn't be surprising that you could see a direct effect on the heart from this virus, and that could cause electrical conduction problems and arrhythmias from the virus itself.
Thank you for explaining that. Sharon, as a follow-up, is that how viruses normally work in terms of, you know, either they have a direct impact or they cause your body to overreact and that sort of thing?
Yes, typically, probably within the first week of infection, it's probably the virus that's doing what it's doing. But then with COVID, it looks like it's the second and third week are more the body's response to the virus as opposed to the virus itself, so the immune response to the virus. And then they're seeing people are presenting with different symptoms and conditions that were initially reported. So, for example, they're seeing some skin conditions, some rashes now. There have been reports on neurological impacts, some confusion, hallucinations, maybe even some signs of encephalopathy, and chest pain as well that's not related to heart attack. And so there's different things that are coming up, and whether or not it's the virus, I think, if anything, if it's the virus, it's probably within the first week or so, and then after that, it's the body's and the body's response to whatever's going on, and maybe some other things that could happen after the virus is no longer in infectious. It could be some other infections or other things that might be going on. Co-infections is something that people are talking about as well, but a lot is not known yet.
Back to the convalescent plasma and the antibodies tests and things like that, this is just sort of what my brain went to. Is there a connection between the severity of the infection and the amount of antibodies that would be present in the plasma?
Well, that's a great question. Nobody knows.
Okay.
You actually knew the answer to that before you asked.
Well, I suspected that was the answer, but I didn't know. I think that's an interesting science experiment.
Yeah, you can have.
How robust the antibody response is. I mean, antibody responses are, you know, it's a basic immunology course here to sort of understand. But that's a great question because you want to use. I want to make sure we understand something. The convalescent plasma sort of is the most diluted way you could use antibodies.
Okay.
It's not being pooled. It's coming from one person to another person. Pooled, you know, you can use pooled antibody from like 1,000 donors. And that would be, and it's concentrating. We're looking, that's the next step of where we would go. So that's like an IgM injection that's pooled. And you can concentrate it for the specific antibody if we knew what it was that are neutralizing antibodies. And then, you know, you move on. So this is a whole spectrum. And then you move on to, you know, ultimately having a vaccine that causes your own body to make the antibody, and it's to protect you from getting the virus. So the initial, just the transfer of one person's antibody and the plasma to another person really does depend on how robust their response was. And if we had a test readily available to look to see what their titer, what are called neutralizing antibodies, is, we'd only want to use people who had a robust response. I do know, you know, from just hearing around that, you know, it really, you think sometimes that it's older people wouldn't have such a good response making antibodies, but apparently that their antibody response to this virus is pretty good.
So in general, it's not so much how many antibodies they have or the concentration of antibodies. They just have to have the right kind of antibodies, neutralizing antibodies, so an immune response can mount a perk up a whole bunch of different antibodies in individuals, but not all of them are going to be neutralizing. And so the tests that are being used to look at antibodies, ELISA assays, for example, or the rapid point of care, they don't really tell you whether or not those antibodies are neutralizing or not, whether or not they can protect you from infection or target the virus specifically. They will bind to the virus, but just because an antibody binds to the virus doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to target it for destruction. And none of the assays that are available will tell you that, other than taking the sample into a lab and doing neutralization assays with actual viruses to determine whether or not the viruses, you know, whether these antibodies are neutralizing or not.
Actually, you know, what I was going to interject there is that I went right to Sharon to sort of see whether we could do a neutralizing assay here in the county, because that's what we really need. The best example I can give is from, you know, my parallel life, really, I don't want to say my former life with HIV, is you have antibodies to HIV. You could do point of testing at home, but those antibodies don't prevent you from getting disease. Or they won't. So they're all different types of antibodies. And, these 70 tests that are out there, it's like the Wild West when it comes to antibody measurement at the moment.
You know, my next question, I was actually going to use the term Wild West. Can you explain what an emergency use authorization means? Because right now it seems like, you know, someday researchers are going to look back on now and there's going to be a lot of interesting data, not just the data, but the way it's being done and how it all plays out.
What I can tell you is that some of the places are not even using an emergency use authorization. So, I mean, this is definitely not my field, but, emergency use authorization was really developed through the FDA for if we had some, like, chemical or biological or nuclear or attack, and they need to have something approved rapidly, to be used that hadn't gone through vigorous testing. So that was the thought process, is to get things out there. And so usually the FDA has, you know, the companies actually do their own testing and then bring it to the FDA, which reviews it and asks for further testing. So I think under emergency use authorization, they have to just tell the FDA that they're doing this in-house validation, but it doesn't have to be completely reviewed. But this is definitely far afield for me, and maybe Sharon knows more of the regulatory side of it.
Yeah, I was just going to add that for the companies for which the USDA is actually not doing the emergency use authorization, but they're letting others move forward, they're asking the companies to state that they've clinically validated their tests using specimens from patients with PCR-confirmed infections. So they're basically putting the onus on the companies to validate their own assays. And, you know, that when you have all these assays out there and companies that are trying to make
chicken
money,
and
it's hard to regulate. So the World Health Organization is looking to, has different groups working with them to basically, there's groups out there, groups that are trying to validate other people's assays. There's a group in Geneva, Switzerland. It's called the Foundation for Innovating Diagnostics, or FIND, and they're basically taking a look at different types of both antibody tests and PCR tests, and primarily they're starting off with tests and kits that were used in China for the first round of evaluation. But there's going to be groups out there that are overseeing, because there's so many, I mean, the USDA just in the U.S. alone cannot keep keep up. And it's not just the U.S. developing these tests and assays. Worldwide, each country is coming up with their own set of assays, and all of those need to be validated in a real quick time frame, right? We want to be able to use these immediately and not wait the normal course that it would normally take to evaluate these things thoroughly. So we're in unknown territory. We have to figure out how to validate, basically how to build a plane while it's on the air.
I just want to emphasize to your audience that this is a real problem, because there are different types of coronaviruses that cause just basic common colds. They're not, the serious COVID-19 disease. And so if these antibodies cross-react and you're using a test that sort of picks up the common cold versus, COVID-19, you can see the problem that you would have using an antibody test. So that's called cross-reactive. It has to be specific to this particular virus, not to the whole family of coronaviruses.
Last question before I let you guys go. I said at the top of the show that, week over week, it seems like things have slowed down a little bit. Does that give you hope? Is that just, it's too early to say anything like the word hope? What are your thoughts? Doug, start with you.
Socially distance, keep doing it. Of course, everyone has hope, but we don't want to become more lax and have a resurgence of disease. So social distance, stay home if you can. You use some sort of face cover if you have to go to grocery shopping or someplace that you have to go to. But really, you have to really stay away from each other so that we don't get a resurgence of the disease.
And Sharon?
Just to reiterate that, the social distance is going to continue to become important. There were some small studies that were done recently just looking at a cohort of women that were admitted for pregnant women who were going to deliver their babies in a New York City hospital. And they found that about 15% of them that came in to deliver, not because they thought they were sick with COVID, they actually were PCR positive for COVID. They did an assay, a similar study, in a homeless shelter in Boston. And they actually found out there that even though all of the people that tested positive for virus were asymptomatic, 36% of the individuals tested were positive. And so there's a lot of people walking out there who are have the virus, they're asymptomatic, they could be spreading it to others. And I guess the more recent one, the U.S. Navy ship, the aircraft carrier, the Roosevelt, they had, about 13% of them tested positive, and most of the individuals were asymptomatic. I think 60% of those that tested positive were asymptomatic. So again, this virus might eventually go away. It may come back again, but for now, I think we just have to remain cautious and be aware that it could be spread even when we don't know that it's around.
Okay, and one more last question. Doug, you mentioned earlier that you had reached out to Sharon. Is there any opportunity for some science happening at FGCU's labs regarding this and all the different aspects of it, Sharon?
So that's a really good question, Mike. So I've done neutralization assays with other viruses. It's a gold standard for determining whether or not the antibodies that you have in serum can actually specifically neutralize the virus. I don't have that up and running right now for coronavirus. That would require some funding.
Okay. Well, we'll follow up on that if that comes through. Thank you guys both for your time. This will be added to the web portion of the show, and I'll follow up, as the week progresses.
All right. Sounds good.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye.
Bye, Mike.
Bye-bye.